many of you were here last week when Pat Prankey spoke primarily about his personal journey and also about the development of Vipassana meditation, especially in the region of Burma. And that particular talk and our listening to it was a wonderful example of a skillful use of thought. You hear a lot about thought in Vipassana practice, and that's one example of a skillful use of thought in his preparation of the material, in his speaking, in our hearing, in our considering, and using that information that he gave us. So tonight I wanted to talk a little bit about the usefulness of thought and the uselessness of thought, because both are true. There's a common misperception, especially among people who are just beginning this practice, that we are trying to stop thoughts. And it kind of sets thought up to be the enemy. So that then when a thought comes, we feel like we failed, or somehow that shouldn't be there. We begin to doubt ourselves if it gets intense enough, or if we are not able to keep the thoughts away, we begin to doubt that we know how to sit and that we can even do the practice. The practice is hard enough without that kind of discouragement. I think that that misperception also feeds a sense of attachment and aversion. Just exactly what we're working to become free of. Because it feeds our attachment to a quiet mind, a mind with fewer thoughts, and our aversion to thought itself. Ooh, there comes one, you know. Make it go away. So we get caught in that attachment-aversion cycle in relation to our own thoughts and the occurrence of those thoughts. Thoughts are going to be there. This is part of the nature of our mind. And we can learn to use them wisely and to know when they're appropriate and when they are skillful, and to know how to use thought and how to work with it when those times come that maybe it's not so useful. You know the directions to simply watch as it arises and as it passes, and to treat thought as one of the primary objects of meditation, not the content of the thought, but the fact that they come and they stay for a period of time and then they go. And to begin to see that as one of the passing phenomena of existence. Suzuki Roshi had a student who said, "I can't stop thinking. No matter what I do, my thoughts are still there. What to do?" And Suzuki Roshi's response was, "Is there some problem with thoughts?" To call the student's attention back to the assumption that there's a problem here. Some of the wise uses of thought, or some of the usefulness of thought, it seems to me, is that thoughts and the words that come from them can be inspirational. We would be, we would have a lot harder time with this practice if it weren't for inspirational words. that come from other people's thoughts. When you think about reading the words of some of the major teachers or some of the people that began this practice or that perpetuated the practice, it would be much more difficult if we didn't have those words. And they came from thoughts. So inspirational thoughts are very helpful to us. Other thoughts give us information that we need simply to live, to get by. You need to know to fill out paperwork in April and send it to the IRS. This comes from thought, but you need to know that. You need to have that information in order to live, to have a reasonably placid existence. And practical thought, planning. You wouldn't even have gotten here tonight if you hadn't planned some way to make that happen. But these are just some of the examples of the usefulness of what we usually think of as thought or discursive thought and reasoning. I did write on this card, brains are us, to remind me to just speak a little bit about our inclination in this very rational left brain culture to think that we are our thoughts, that we are our brain, that our brain is the primary organ of the body. So even though thoughts are useful in many ways, we have a tendency to either overvalue them or to undervalue the other pieces of our lives and our existence. Brains are not us. Gil Fronsdale gave a marvelous Dharma talk about mind and here mind, in which he essentially said that we are always either an about mind, thinking about something, or we're here. And we have that choice to make in every moment. Are you right now about, are you thinking about something, or are you here? And that this is the difference between presence and being involved in discursive thought. So it's always about something. There's always a piece of content to that aboutness. What so often happens is that we grasp at that, whatever it's about, that there is a grasping at that, and we begin to identify with that, and to think that that's us. At least for the moment, that's who I am. Because that's my thought. In this way, thought becomes an obstacle to our direct experience. It distances our direct experience. We live so often in about mind rather than here, in here mind. It becomes an obstacle to life. We think our lives instead of being present to live our lives. Alan Watts said, when we dance, the journey itself is the point. As when we play the music, the playing is itself is the point. Meditation is the discovery that the point of life is always arrived at in the immediate moment. You're listening to a concerto, you're not listening waiting for the last note. You know? You're not. You're listening to this note. When I think about thought, it reminds me of my personal journey to this point, to this journey of spirit. I spent my early years in being raised in a family in the Protestant faith, Christian Protestant. And in my first marriage as well, I was married to a man who was Christian Protestant. I then began a journey of attending churches that were more progressive socially and politically, but still with a Christian background. At some point there, I began attending a Unitarian church and found that at that time that fit my needs and was such a wonderful freeing experience intellectually and socially. I drank it deeply. The experience with First Unitarian Church of Dallas, actually. So it was a very, very large church. But getting back to the business of thought, I began to notice that I missed something, that there was a piece that I missed personally that had not necessarily been affirmed in my Christian upbringing, because I don't think it's affirmed in most Christian churches. But that was in me personally, and I still missed it in my years as a Unitarian. And that was the piece of the mystical that did not seem to get honored, the contemplative and the mystical, that I personally missed. It seemed to transcend discursive thought. I think that's why it occurred to me to speak about that. Well, at the time that this happened, when I began to notice that, I was swimming, I was swimming regularly, and I swam with a couple of nuns, Roman Catholic nuns. I called them the swimming nuns. And they were members of a very progressive Roman Catholic church in Dallas that happened to be serving as sanctuary for Salvadoran refugees. So this fit with my political leanings, and I thought, well, maybe there's a piece of the mystical here, and I really like these women. So I started going to church with them, and I made the odd shift from being Unitarian to being Roman Catholic. Most people go the other way. But at the time, it answered that piece in me that wanted ritual, that wanted something more that I could feel was more contemplative. I stayed in that scenario for as long as I could. And then began to see the reasons why I needed to move on to something else. In the meantime, I had started a Buddhist practice. And I remember fairly early on in the Buddhist practice, in those years, attending a retreat that was led by Joseph Goldstein. And I remember being in an interview with Joseph and saying, I am really struggling with Buddhism, Christianity, I'm struggling with this. And his response was something like, you don't need to struggle. You just don't need to struggle. You can honor both. And I thought, I can? So that was the bit, that was a wonderful turning point for me in the way that I thought about my own internal journey. That I could, and it's enlarged since then, to the feeling that I can take from any number of wisdom traditions that which seems to work, that which seems to be consistent with my own experience. That was the piece that Buddhism offered me that I had not felt before. And that was this direction back to your own experience. as the Buddha taught us. Don't take my word for it. Robert Thurman says, don't be Buddhist. Okay? Go back to your own experience and see what's true for you. And to have that affirmed and have that encouraged was just phenomenally freeing for me. And I think which is one of the main reasons I've stayed with this practice. And it is intimately connected with skillful use of thought and knowing when to let go of thought and to simply be present with my own experience. When we become involved with the content of our thoughts, again, not thought as a process, not thought as clouds passing by, which is what we're encouraged to do in the meditation practice, but rather when we get involved in a specific thought or a number of specific thoughts and get sucked in and carried along with that, what happens is that we are building a sense of self. We are nurturing a sense of this is who I am. And this is kind of what the end result of being so involved in our thoughts is that we fool ourselves into this sense of a concrete unchanging self. It begins to look like that's me. And I start to weave the story of Glenda. You start to weave the story of you. And you believe it, and you look at it and listen to it, and you tell other people about it, don't you? Tell other people the story of you as if it were true, as if it is true on some level. You do the certain things, but as if it were the ultimate reality, as if it were unchanging. This is where thought leads when we're not mindful that it's happening. With this construction of a sense of self comes the need to defend that self, the need to protect that self. Because if I really believe that this is me, then that means you are you, separate from me. And that means I need to protect what I consider to be me or mine. And it sets up a sense of defensiveness against anything else or anyone else, anyone that is not like me. So I just want to show you where that leads. I want you to think about, okay, where that leads to erect that sense of self. Automatically, almost, comes with it this defensive posture, this need to protect who I believe that I am. The logical outgrowth of that is what we see in the newspapers, war, us against them, because obviously they're not like me. One thing that we try to do also with this story that we have formed out of thoughts is we may notice that there are things about it we don't like and we try to improve the story. Okay? If only I had a better story, then what? Then I'd be happy. Believing that that leads to happiness. This is a tragic mistake that we make. Believing that if we could only make a better story, that we'd be happy. It's not the content of the story that's the issue, that's the problem. It's the fact that we identified as ourselves. So in this practice, we're encouraged to look behind the story, behind the thoughts, to see if we can find a storyteller. Okay? the producer of this movie to see if we can find that. And when we truly pay close attention, we're not able to find an unchanging entity that is producing all of this. There is no storyteller, finally. I was interested in the fact that as I started working on speaking about thoughts, that my Buddha Dharma came. It's a wonderful quarterly journal. And there's an article in here called, it's a forum. Three teachers are asked this question: do Buddhists think? Wasn't that timely? So I wanted to read you a little bit of the responses from these three Buddhist teachers. One is from the Vipassana tradition, one is from the Zen tradition, and one is from the Tibetan tradition. Narayan Levinson Grady says this: as I understand it, the awakened mind includes thinking. It's just that the thinking is necessary, functional, and discerning, rather than indulgent, unnecessary, and addictive. Without attachment to thinking, silence and peace are available. In not grasping after thoughts and taking them to be me and mine, there is freedom instead of bondage. Buddhas plan, but they don't engage in worry. They make decisions, but are not swayed by self-centered emotion. Buddhas are immeasurably creative, but not interested in fantasy. Buddhas think, but are not caught up in their thoughts, and they do not mistake their thoughts to be who they are. They are present in the midst of thoughts arising, and they use thinking as a way to benefit all beings. That's her response. The Zen teacher, Zenkei Blanche Hartman, directs us to the Dhammapada, Gil Fronsdale's translation. In those writings, Shakyamuni Buddha teaches this: all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow. He abused me, attacked me, defeated me, robbed me. For those carrying on like this, hatred does not end. She abused me, attacked me, defeated me, robbed me. For those not carrying on like this, hatred ends. There is something in Buddhist teachings called the proliferation of thought. I don't know whether you've heard those words used exactly like that, but I love that image, the proliferation of thought. And when you're sitting and watching the breath and beginning to watch the mind, you can see this happening. I call it the bubble machine, because one thought comes, and the next thought, and then, and before you know it, it's going like this, and you could just see them. It's wow, the proliferation of thought. Yeah, it happens. So that's a phenomenon that you just need to be watchful for. You don't have to push it away, but it would be helpful to notice when it happens. You can sometimes sit in awe of it because it is really awful. proliferation of thoughts. Thought itself is discouraged in the Dzogchen tradition. It's a Tibetan tradition. It's very, not just hair-centered, but very body-centered. If you get a chance to sit with Sokni Rinpoche, I hope you will do that. He is a Dzogchen master, and he is phenomenal. He has been here in Louisville, and I hope we'll come back. In the Dzogchen tradition, thought is discouraged because it won't liberate, because it doesn't lead to freedom. So it's just a matter of why bother with it, or you know, we don't want to encourage it because it doesn't lead there. It leads to suffering. Rather, what's encouraged is to stay with the body, which is the first foundation of mindfulness, being present with the body and whatever's going on there. The breath is ideal as a starting place because it comes unbidden and leaves when it wants to. You may have noticed. You don't say, come here, in breath. You know, it comes to you. And it stays, and when it's ready, it leaves. So it makes it a marvelous object of the practice, because it's beyond our control. We can influence it to some extent, but basically it's beyond our control. Just a little bit about what the third teacher, who was a Tibetan teacher, said about when asked, "Do Buddhas think?" He was came closer to saying no. Okay, but really qualified it, and this was part of that. The more we identify with our stories and the one creating the stories, the more we are trapped in our pain. Freeing oneself from pain is not a matter of finding a better story. Instead, we must find the storyteller. Yet, when we search for the storyteller, we cannot find anything solid that is itself not just another story. So, in meditation practice, don't do anything. Allow thought. It will dissolve. As we meditate, we become more and more familiar with the openness we experience as our grasping dissolves. In this way, we recognize our true nature as Buddha, and positive qualities are naturally and spontaneously available for the benefit of others. So there's this focusing on enlarging the spaciousness of mind so that the boundaries begin to dissolve, the boundary between me and you, the perceived boundary begins to dissolve. And the mind gets so much more spacious. This is about thought. This is from Gosanananda. Thought manifests as the word. The word manifests as the deed. The deed develops into habit. The habit hardens into character. The character gives birth to destiny. So, watch your thoughts with care and let them spring from love born out of respect for all beings. is the skillful encouragement of that kind of thought. And I want to close by reading something from Achan Cha. About this mind, in truth, it isn't really anything. It's just a phenomenon. Within itself, it's already peaceful. That the mind is not peaceful these days is because it follows moods. The real mind doesn't have anything to it. It simply is an aspect of nature. It becomes peaceful or agitated because moods deceive it. The untrained mind is stupid. Sense impressions come and trick it into happiness, suffering, gladness, sorrow. But the mind's true nature is none of those things. That gladness or sadness is not the mind, but only a mood coming to deceive us. The untrained mind gets lost and follows these things. It forgets itself. Then we think that it is we who are upset or at ease or whatever. But really, this mind of ours is already unmoving and peaceful. Real peaceful. Just like a leaf, which is still as long as no wind blows. If a wind comes up, the leaf flutters. The fluttering is due to the wind. The fluttering is due to those sense impressions. The mind follows them. If it doesn't follow them, it doesn't flutter. If we know fully the true nature of sense impressions, we are unconcerned. Our practice is simply to see the original mind. So we must train the mind to know those sense impressions and not get lost in them, to make it peaceful. Just this is the aim of all this difficult practice we put ourselves through.